It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
A wizard's ancient spell.
Into the eyes of the dragon and in despair.
And the lust of a lord.
I must have her. One night with her.
Give birth to an empire.
Behold the sword of power, Excalibur.
The future has taken root in the present. It is done.
Orion Pictures presents John Boorman's Excalibur.
Knights of the Round Table, we shall always come together in a circle to hear and tell of deeds good and brave. And I will marry.
Don't you know me, Merlin? Because I'm a creature like you.
Their magic is Merlin.
Are you just a dream to some?
A nightmare to others.
Their king is Arthur.
You are my husband.
I must be king first.
Their power is Excalibur.
I swear eternal faith to Arthur, king.
Sir Lancelot, you will be my champion.
What is that? Greatest quality of knighthood.
Truth.
Where hides evil then?
Where you never expected.
I protest my innocence.
Were I not king, I would make you pay with your life.
A world of wizards, kings, warriors, queens, swords, sorcery, and desire. Forged of splendor and magic, where future meets past, flesh meets steel, and the only fear is the pain of love. Excalibur, sword of power, sword of kings.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am joined, as always, by my Is It Jaws partner, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here, as always, sir.
And it is a pleasure to have you. And we are doing our crossover episode with Back to the Bins. Having completed Camelot 3000, we've decided to visit Camelot in another way, and we are covering Excalibur from 1981. So to cover that movie, we decided to bring in our table round expert, Mr. Gene Hendricks.
The Two True Freaks Network. The podcasts were divided and without a movie review show. Out of those lost recordings rose a legend of the executive producer, of his knowledgeable co-host, of their amazing guests. Is it Jaws?
Thank you for having me on, guys.
Ooh, that may awesome. Be a commercial.
Feel free to pull it out.
Very nice. Now, my history with this particular film is I saw it on VHS when it was released, I assume somewhere around 1982 or 1983. In the 1980s, I probably saw it about five or six times. And since the end of that decade, I don't think I actually watched it again until this week when I watched it. So I have good memories of the movie. I have some critique of it. Overall, I like this movie a lot. I am a fan of the Arthurian legend, although I am not a devotee, as Mr. Hendricks is, but I find it to be very enjoyable. Sean, what is your take on Excalibur?
So our pathway was pretty similar. Whenever this hit cable, so, you know, back in the early days of cable, Showtime, HBO, that type of thing. I don't remember which channel, but this came on. And when it first hit, I saw it. I was a fan of the King Arthur legend, like you were mentioning, Paul. I'd read some books. I'm not going to pretend I'm like an expert or anything like that, but I really enjoy it. So when I saw this film, I'm like, oh, wow, cool. King Arthur was great. And so much, I actually want to be very careful not to tip my hat of where I'm at with it right now, other than the fact that this is something that I watch regularly over the years. Last time I saw it was a couple years ago. It was one of those where I'm like, oh, I haven't seen that in a while. Like, don't watch it. One of those pieces. Funny enough, Paul, you and I have talked about films that haven't been done on Is It Jaws yet and making up a list of films that I was intrigued by doing. I'm surprised I didn't have this one on the list. for a lot of the obvious reasons we're going to discuss today. So this is going to be a fun one to deep dive into.
What's your background, Gene?
Well, this is one that it was in the house because, and I believe it was HBO that this was on. If those of us of a certain age remember the VHS compilation tapes that we used to have. So this is one that, this was the first one on the tape. The tape included Excalibur, Star Trek II, and The Sword and the Sorcerer.
Oh, yeah.
So it was one that I would throw in all the time. Eventually, I got the VHS on its own when that came out. I want to say mid to late 80s that came out. And then I got it on Blu-ray within the past, like, 6 years, something like that. And the funny thing about it is, when I watched the Blu-ray, there was a scene I had never seen before. When Uther, in the form of the Duke of Cornwall, comes in and meets with Egrain and then takes her dress down, right? On the HBO version and the VHS I had, that's where it stopped. Blu-ray's in, I'm watching it, and all of a sudden, oh, they're actually showing him impregnating her. Okay, I don't remember that one.
I seem to recall that being there on the version that I had seen all the time, but okay.
Well, as you know, they have different versions for different things.
Different age groups.
Yes, but that's actually that movie inspired me to read Le Morte d'Arthur and get involved with the Arthurian stuff.
Oh, interesting.
And, I won't go beyond that because anything I say beyond that is going to tip my hand as to my rating.
Just you know, as a thought on Egrain, since that came up, is I remember like seeing it and not quite feeling the lust that Uther felt that you were supposed to. You know, oh, look at her, she's so beautiful, you have to have her. And I was thinking, yeah, she's a good-looking woman. But, right. You know, like, and then I didn't know until, doing my minor research for this, that she's John Borman's daughter. So that when he cast the film, he cast his daughter as that role. Not necessarily a role I'd want my daughter to be in, but...
No!
A little nepotism in the casting, let's just say that.
Okay, that explains it.
Now, this movie has the distinction of containing many actors who I was unfamiliar with at the time and have become very familiar with since.
Yep.
So I found that interesting, much more interesting watching it now that I'm familiar with all these actors than I did in the 80s when I was still ignorant of some of them. Looking back, if you told me Gabriel Byrne was going to be in this movie, I would have immediately said Lancelot. So I'm a little surprised that he was Uther. You know, the major surprise actors are Patrick Stewart and Liam Neeson.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe it's the first film role for both. I think they were both stage actors up until this point.
Yeah, I think that Stewart did this and then immediately went on and did Dune.
Which,
very, very close.
I can tell you, I still have never seen.
Okay.
To this day. So I did not become familiar with him until Star Trek The Next Generation.
What's interesting with him is knowing what you know now about like his background and his passions. This film had to have been like a jackpot film for him, just to be a part of this, just because of his history with stage and how much he loves this kind of thing. I would think at the time. No,
you would think, yes, but it wasn't. I've read his autobiography,
mm-hmm.
and he talked about his time in the Royal Shakespeare Company, his time meeting Brian Blessed as a child,
yeah.
his time when he went to do Dune, Star Trek, etc. No mention of this movie at all.
Baffles me. It completely baffles me because you would think with all of the checkboxes of, I mean, he's in many interviews talked about his... stage being a passion of his and Shakespeare and all those pieces. This just seems like it would be the one that kind of goes, hey, and I'm really glad I did that Excalibur flick.
Yeah, I was surprised that he didn't mention it one bit.
So just sticking with the casting a little bit, one of the things I found fascinating was the casting of Helen Mirren as Morgan Le Fay opposite Nicole Williamson as Merlin, because when I read this a little bit, the reason apparently that Borman cast the two of them is because they had been in some production several years earlier, some sort of Shakespearean production, and hated each other. And he thought that would come through on the screen for these two characters. And I just think that's one of the most interesting casting choices that I've ever read about.
And it worked pretty well. I mean, Nicole Williamson is just Merlin in my head. And anytime I am reading something about Merlin or trying to do something with Merlin, that's the intonation I try and get going.
And yet, in my mind, when I picture Merlin independent of this movie, I picture much more what you get for Gandalf or Dumbledore or, you know, even Obi-Wan Kenobi, which, you know, they are all archetypes of the same role. And that's another thing I just, you know, I want to get back to it, but I just want to mention how this movie, it comes... It's the information in this movie or the story of this movie is a source of inspiration for Star Wars, and then that gets turned around with Star Wars being a, you know, predecessor to this movie, and I think a big reason why this movie got greenlit. So, you know, kind of an interesting combination, but we'll stick with the casting for now.
And he plays a brilliant role because of how complex his character is. I mean, when you take a look at him in the beginning with Uther, you know, there's a very different man. There's a creep factor to him in all of that. Almost a disconnect. Like, you know, he is this magical being that's looking down. And then he goes to somebody who's much more grounded. He's almost like Yoda. Like, he's whimsical and things like that when he's with Arthur later on. Playful in those pieces. It doesn't take away, because of what we saw earlier with him, he still has got that being of power, but there's something more personal about him later. And I think it's perfect for where the story goes. But it is in the runtime they've got of this film, he goes on quite a journey, which is very interesting considering what Merlin is in this piece. And I think she did too. In her own story there, the casting of this was brilliant. And, Helen Mirren playing, kind of his foil, in this whole piece, I think you needed her build as well. This film really did a great job with giving us a villain cast that you actually wanted to see the heroes defeat, and they felt imposing. And scary. There was a definite creep factor to this film, in a very complicated way, because this is a complicated movie. There's a lot of layers to this one to unpack, and a lot of factions, I think, to kind of talk about.
Yes.
So the main role in this is Nigel Terry as Arthur, and the thing that I found most fascinating about that is, if I understood correctly, he was 35 years old when they filmed this. And he starts the movie playing a 15-year-old version of Arthur and is kind of convincing in the role. Mm-hmm. And that's, pre-CGI, so, I hats off to him on that. I thought he had a very complex role to play, because he goes from young and inquisitive to the king to very dour. So he had to show some range in this, and I thought he did a good job.
It's also a testament to costuming, makeup, and practical effects.
Yes.
Because everything, we're watching this today, right? And it looked good. I mean, he looked like the boy king at that point, Paul. I couldn't agree with you more. And that was obviously, want to give the appropriate props to him, because if you're not acting that out right, we're not believing it. But, we also didn't have to have this disbelief because the practical effects didn't work. Boy, did they make him look younger and make him look way old by the end of the film. I mean, we've got a nice age span for him, and it all looked good. Really, yeah, impressive.
Absolutely. Just actually going back to Merlin for a moment, what I enjoyed about the way he played the part, because it was very complex, is he is presented as someone who knows everything that's going on behind the scenes. He's not letting people in on what's doing. And yet he could also be a clumsy oaf at the same time. when he grabs the fish and he falls in the water, it was just very interesting the way that the character was portrayed. And I think he did a great job with it. I've only seen him in a handful of things. And they've generally been very different from this. So, again, hats off to that role. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the actor and actress that played Lancelot and Guinevere. I thought they were fairly convincing in their roles. I thought they fit the parts. I didn't think the parts required them to go too far afield, though. I don't think it required all that much range. The only thing that required the range was the love triangle. And I think that presented in the scene when Lancelot is accompanying her to the wedding, and he tells her that he's in love with her. And then the reactions of the two, and I thought that was played very well.
I really liked with her, when in her introduction, when we see her during the Boy King's raid, where he's trying to help out, and she's looking at him, this almost like this peculiar little man with fascination. And I mean, you see it in her face. She's the fascination that she has for the craziness of, he doesn't have any armor on or anything like that. And he's climbing up and almost like blunt forcing himself to try and help in those situations. She's just watching realistically, and I think she's right, what is he doing? But he's going with passion. He's got an ethical code, and we're seeing the hope that Arthur brings when he shows up on the scene. And he made choices like that throughout the film, but I loved seeing her do that piece. And you're right about the scene before the wedding. One of the things that I liked was when she's like almost trying to play matchmaker with him, with the girls that are in front. And as he is revealing his true feelings, you see her edging back on the horse. I thought it's a great example of not just acting, but stage direction, like saying, hey, that horse needs to come back a little bit. And it was subtle, but you saw it kind of go through. There were some choices made in this film that I just thought were really, really subtle things that were smart, that added like this whole layer of she's like in shock and awe. And that situation totally impacted her. And their relationship changed forever after that conversation. And yes. I just loved the way that visually it played out, as well as what they were doing with acting.
Yeah, and we'll get to it, but the music adds to every single scene.
Yes.
They do it just right as far as, like, that scene, he says it, she reacts, and the music's like, you know, it's telling you, oh, big moment. Things are changed now. I've never seen her in anything else that I remember. But Nicholas Clay, he actually popped up in the Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes series. He played a doctor, the resident patient, I think was the episode. He showed up, it's like, oh, Lancelot. But completely different personality and everything in that. He's a really good actor. Especially when he goes nuts at the end of the movie.
Other key roles, Paul Joffrey as Percival. I don't have a lot to say about his performance. I thought he did well. It really came, you know, the key was when he was on the search for the Holy Grail. You know, he kind of came front and center at that point, and he carried the film for a few minutes. Excuse me. And I thought he did well. I don't really have a lot to say about it.
Two pieces I liked about him. It was the sequence where he had to be Lancelot's stand-in, which I think is something that a squire would do if they really believed in their knight and they really believed in the code. He's coming and stepping up. You got the rest of the knights of the round table. Not a one of them is stepping up. This kid is. He's not a knight yet. And he's going, I mean, he was ready to go until Lancelot came in. We all know that Lancelot's hurt at that point.
Yeah.
And this kid is like stepping up. What this time around, I don't know what it was that he clicked for, the character of Percival clicked for me more this time, in the sense that he maintains throughout his introduction into the film the best of Camelot. Like, he is drawn to Lancelot and wants to be Lancelot's squire because he's believing in all of this. He's part of the Camelot and everything that's going on that's good, and he wants to be a part of it. He wants to be a knight. He wants to, you know, do all of these things. He never loses that throughout the film. He takes that moment where he's going to step in for Lancelot. And then when the rest of the knights are kind of being cut down for the Holy Grail quest, he sees dead bodies. He sees people killed in front of him. He sees a hopeless quest. He's still able to maintain the hope, even when Arthur doesn't have it, and kind of persevere off of that piece. He becomes critical at the end, which is so funny because he is, to your point, Paul, he seems so much like a minor character, but yet he's really the heart at the very end of it, which I never noticed before this particular viewing. And I'm like, oh, wow, he kind of like is the only one who holds it together when it's the hardest to.
He's also the one that inadvertently causes a lot of knights to die because he's the one that says the oath. We will find this grail or die. Well, you just spoke a holy oath about a holy relic. You're going to get held to it. But, yeah, that's the reason that he is, like, in the original text, when Mallory conflated all these different legends together, Percival was like number two. Galahad was the perfect knight, who was frankly boring. I mean, he was the best of everything, the most moral, etc. He's the one that achieved the Grail Quest. Percival was right there with him for his innocence, for his honor and everything. He just couldn't quite make it. He wasn't that. He was too human, essentially, is what it boils down to. And you see this where he's the wild boy, like the farm boy that wandered away and met this knight. You know, it's 3 days. The world is not that big. And his world is just expanded once he gets to Camelot, brains Merlin, and gets, you know, his eyes opened, but never loses that innocence, never loses that what this is what is right.
And maybe Galahad's perfection is why, when I look over the cast list, his name is not there.
Right. They trimmed a lot of people in this. Like, they took all three of Arthur's sisters and merged them into one.
So, getting to the movie itself, or the production of the movie itself, apparently Borman, who I would say has a mixed level of career, he directed Deliverance, which is routinely considered to be a classic. He directed The Exorcist II, which is routinely considered to be one of the worst movies ever. So, you know, you're going to get whatever you get from him. In this case, I understand he was lobbying to do a production of Lord of the Rings from the early 70s, and it kept getting shot down based upon production costs. And then in 1977, there was a movie that made a little bit of money that had a fantasy element to it, and I think that is the reason why this eventually got green lit. But it was converted. Apparently the script for Lord of the Rings, some of that was worked into this script, or at least certain scenes that they wanted to do. I mean, obviously it's an adaptation of you know, the Thomas Malory's book, and it seems to stick pretty close to it. But they must have taken some scenes that they wanted to do and adapted them to Malory's story somehow. At least that's how I understand it. The problem I have, and this is my overwhelming problem as in critiquing the movie, is this probably should have been done as a miniseries. This should probably be a 10-hour movie. And even with trying to pare it down, this feels like a 4-hour movie stuck in a 2-hour and 20-minute bag. There could have been so much more exposition and storytelling to how we got to certain points. I feel as if the story is presented from a point of view of either just take the ride and don't think too much, or you already know the legend and you know what we're doing. Because if you don't, you're going to be lost. Any thoughts?
I agree that there is too much story for the runtime. Even 10 hours is not enough, to be honest. If you go from Uther to the death of Arthur, you're talking like 80 years of span. And there's so many different things going on in there, so many different legends. Watching James Campbell, you know, every once in a while, and he'll bring it up, and it's like, oh, there was this legend, and this legend, and this legend. And you have to remember, I saw this when I was very young, but for me, and for my sister, who is a huge Helen Mirren fan because of this movie, we didn't know any of this. There wasn't anything there in popular culture to give me any of this information, and we were great. You know, we loved it, and like I said, this is what got me to dive more into it. But yeah, there could be more explanation. Like, for example, for the longest time, I thought Morgana was artificially aging Mordred. Not, oh, no, this is just the span of years being shown in one scene. Yeah, there's stuff, you know, if they had explained that more, oh, it would make more sense. So, yeah, I agree with you, but for what it is, this is... I'm going to tip my rating a little bit. There was a more recent director that had made a King Arthur movie that said it is impossible to make a good King Arthur movie tell the tale of King Arthur in 2 hours. My reply was, yes, it takes 2 hours and 12 minutes.
Here's where I want what you're asking for. So it's, as you're sitting here saying, I want it to be a miniseries or, you know, 4 hour movie or beyond. I want that. Looking at this film though, and what the time frame they had, where you're trying to deal with a film going audience, I think they did a bang up job with the time frame that they had in front of them. Just looking at it from a movie standpoint, I would love all the extra exposition that we're talking about, because I think actually would I agree with Gene. I thought for the longest time too that he was artificially aged. You know, there's a point in multiple viewings where you're like, oh wait a minute, that's not what happened. But I mean, that's certainly something I want to say, and I'm going to be very clear. Multiple viewings before I realized that was a thing. I was always under the impression, and once I got that idea, no other viewing afterwards like hit that for me until, you know, until I revisited again when I was older, mm-hmm. And then I'm like, oh wait a minute, that didn't happen that way. I feel like they had all the right beats to make an effective beginning, middle, and ending of this story, with recognizing that I don't know that the audience would have gone for like a 3 or 4 hour movie. And to your point about TV, I loved maxi series on TV, you know, five day, you know, Monday through Friday watching this bad boy. This would have been great on TV. The only thing is they wouldn't have gone some of the edgy places that I think that they did in this one that I think makes this film kind of intriguing. They skirted some lines on this film, and I think it needed to, because I think it adds a sense of the time frame that they're talking about, adds a sense to the fantasy aspect of this, kind of the creepy factor of magic. I really like that sometimes you see magic and it's like, you know, as a kid I was growing up with Doug Henning, it's magic, you know, and everything. You see this isn't Doug Henning. This is a very, very creepy level of magic. It makes you scared of magic in all the right ways. And I think it's just because of the fact that this film was skirting some lines. It's intriguing, because I want everything you have. It sounds like I'm disagreeing with you. I'm not. I want what you're asking for, because I would love to have seen that miniseries with being able to do it with this sensibility.
Now, the scene when he pulls Excalibur out of the stone, what is that, about 15 minutes into the movie, say, roughly?
Something like that, yeah, 15, 20 minutes. Yeah.
That, from the beginning to that, could easily be the first part of a miniseries, two-hour episode.
Oh, yeah.
And it ends with Arthur pulling the sword out, and then seeing that there's some disagreement among the people as to whether or not he is truly the king, to be continued.
Yeah, well, for the people at home, I'm about to show Paul and Sean a book, which is, I would say, about 3/4 to an inch thick. This is, it's called The Great Pendragon Campaign. It is for the Pendragon role-playing game. What this book is a year-by-year listing of events.
Oh.
Starting from when Uther becomes king until the death of Arthur. I could take every single year of this and make it a TV movie. Every single year. Even, yeah, there's stuff in here. And when we're talking, and Greg Stafford, the late Greg Stafford, did a wonderful job of getting everything, he condensed everything from all different sources, including this movie. The Uther and Cornwall scene where he reveals Excalibur is in this book. because it is just it was that powerful scene. But this takes you from year 485 to year 566. So I can make you a 5 or 6 season TV movie extravaganza just based on this. So we're talking a lot of information.
And that's when I come down to it, despite my affection for this movie, that's where I have to be objective and say the movie does suffer from some information failure and some pacing difficulties at times. I don't want to put that all at the feet of Borman, because I'm sure he was under extreme pressure to make this, not only for the running time, but probably also for the budget, to pare things down somewhat and move it along. And, you know, I would imagine, I didn't actually look to the budget. Budget was $11 million, which in 1981 was, you know, probably a relatively high budget. And the box office for U.S. and Canada is listed as $35 million. So it was a hit. This is a movie, despite the fact that it was a hit, I think it gained more legs on home video than it had in the theater. Yes. You know, being a little older than the two of you, I would have, had it been any type of phenomena in the theater, I would have been aware of it. And I really wasn't. So I'm thinking, you know, it came, it did well, and it went away. And then it came out on video, and then people started to discover it. And that certainly was the case for me. And again, when I watched this in the 80s, when I was in my 20s, the pacing problems did not really disturb me. I enjoyed the spectacle. This movie certainly has plenty of that. And I enjoyed that, and I enjoyed the way it does stay true to the legend. So I felt like it taught me a lot about the legend, even though it necessarily had to pare down certain aspects of it.
Backing you up on some of this, I'm thinking back in the 80s when I watched it, nobody was talking about this. Like, it wasn't something, you know, in my, like, my friendship group, like, friends were talking about, hey, man, did you see Excalibur? There's truth to that. You know, this one kind of flew under the, at least I will say in my crowd, flew under the radar. And it was very common for us to talk about films that we'd seen during that end. This was one, like I said, I came across it on, and I think, Gene, I think you're right, it's probably HBO, and I can almost play the old HBO logo in my head as we're watching that. I caught it on a whim, but I got to say, that was at an era where HBO was destination television. You know, you didn't have streaming, you didn't have, like, it was you walk in, this is what's on now, and you're committed to sitting there. There's no pause.
Right. Yeah. It was okay. It's coming on at 8:30 tonight. You had better be ready to sit until 11 o'clock.
This is a film, though, that I jumped in a lot of times partway through because I'm like, oh, I like that. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of my experience watching it, was a lot of times jumping in, you know, halfway through, a quarter of the way through, whatever it was, and just kind of continuing to journey on with this film because of it. But it was not. I should have looked beforehand how this did in the theaters, just to kind of get kind of a baseline off of that. But I'm actually surprised with the friends that I hang out with that like very similar films that I do, that this was not one that we talked about ever.
One interesting thought I had was that Monty Python and the Holy Grail was released, I believe, 7 or 8 years before this movie. And yet it seems, if you watch them in reverse order, it feels that is a direct parody of this movie. Which I think speaks to the fact of how true to the legend this movie is. That the other movie parodied it before it was even made, because it parodied the legend.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you even have some of the same kinds of scenes, like when England is in its decline and the peasants are starving and everything. That looks like the scenes when Arthur's just going through the town in Monty Python. Help, help, I'm being repressed. It's the same look of everything. So maybe Borman saw it like, hey, that'll work over here. I don't know. But yeah, it's the same kind of thing like with Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe.
Yes.
These movies came out at the same time, but it looks like one's a parody of the other.
Very, very good comparison.
Building off of what you're saying, Paul, I would say if you've watched Holy Grail, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and don't know anything about the Arthurian legend except for that, I'd recommend watching this. Because actually it'll make you appreciate what they were doing in Holy Grail even more. Because they did a really good job of parodying Arthurian legend in that. And it shows you the brilliance of Monty Python, I think, as well.
Earlier, Gene, you mentioned the score. Where I lost it. Here we go. Where? Had it. Hold on.
In there somewhere.
Thank God for editing. I don't know where I lost it. I'm kind of annoyed.
You looking for Trevor Jones, the composer?
No, I wasn't looking for him. I was looking for something where they comment about how the score. Oh, there it is. So, in the Wikipedia page, it mentions that the film soundtrack features the movie of Richard Wagner, which I was unaware, and Carl Orff, who I'm not familiar with, along with the original score by Trevor Jones. So it's combining three different sources of music, and yet, to me, it felt seamless. And it did feel, as you mentioned earlier, that it properly emphasizes scenes without overdoing it. There's never a point where the music becomes intrusive, but it definitely plays on the emotions that you're feeling, or that you should be feeling, which is exactly what a score should do. I can't say I listened to it closely enough to know if I'd want to listen to it independent of the movie, but I would say the possibility does exist.
Well, I have listened to it independent of the movie. I actually made a cassette tape. I had to get, and this was at the time when you do CDs and cassettes at the same time. I had to get multiple CDs, Wagner, Orff, and everything to make the Excalibur tape that I made. The only contribution from Orff's selection is O Fortuna, which is the song that they're riding and everything is blooming again. And everything else is either Trevor Jones' original stuff or a lot of Wagner. There is a huge amount of Wagner in this. And I've listened to it all on its own, and it brings back all the memories of watching the movie. Not that that's exactly far from the top of my mind at most periods, because I can recite whole scenes from this.
I want to say one thing about the soundtrack. This is a soundtrack. I picked this up from Comic Geek Speak years ago, listening to certain soundtracks while you read comics and things like that. This is one of the soundtracks I'll listen to. Just because the music, I think, lends itself when you're reading stories where there's adventure and action and all those pieces in there. It's a beautiful soundtrack for that. The film, I think, really has that kind of, it carries you through the story, the music. And I think it works very well with other stories. If you haven't tried it, this is a good soundtrack for that.
Now, this was filmed in Ireland, and apparently, you know, there was a significant number of Irish actors in it. And apparently this movie did have a positive effect on filmmaking in that country. So there's a little bit of a legacy there as well. Looking again to John Borman's direction, again, I thought he played the spectacle very well in it. And again, you know, we go into the, you know, the son begat the father begat the son. I think, you know, he was originally going to make Lord of the Rings. He made this. And I suspect that there were things in this that influenced Peter Jackson when he did make Lord of the Rings. So, you know, it all comes full circle kind of thing, which I find to be a kind of a fun concept. Only difference is that Peter Jackson was given the, whatever it is, 9 hours that Borman needed.
Well, about 12 if you watch the extended editions.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because they bump up to about 4 hours each. Any other thoughts?
Excalibur. I just want to kind of just real quickly shout out how they handled Excalibur, the lady in the lake. Just very beautiful, the way that the hand came out with the sword and just adding kind of a majesty to it. But also when he and Lancelot are dueling, not dueling, I mean, they're having a fight to the death, and Arthur's rage and pride, and we got to see it really from some great acting as far as his irrational reaction. This boy king who we've all at this point kind of fallen in love with, the fact that he's just such an ethically good guy, you know, cracks and literally breaks the sword because he's broken in those moments. And, you know, this sword being this symbol of hope, and we don't quite understand yet that hope is coming from inside this person. The fact that the glowing of the sword, the way the lady held it in the lake, we're, you know, again, I'm watching this movie now and I'm like, the effects and the use of the effects and all of that with the sword, I thought was something. Excalibur could have just been a sword, right? The way that they handled it in this, it looked and felt special because of how the scenes were shot and how the effects were taking place. And those effects still stand up today in a way that I thought was really cool. It's when you're talking Arthurian legend, especially when we're talking about a director who wanted to do Lord of the Rings. There's certain key elements in these type of stories that you either make feel special or you get it wrong. They got Excalibur right in this, and it was something that I just thought really stood out. So I just wanted to shout that out just because we hadn't really talked about the sword much, and I thought that was kind of a neat piece that they
especially
made stand
since
out.
The movie's named after it.
Yeah. You would think, yeah.
But I think you hit on one of the key theme, or basically the key theme of this movie is the price of pride and lust and what it does, you know, how it affects you. I mean, we go from Uther and what happens with him, and then, you know, the love triangle and Arthur's pride and how this all gets lost, and then the land starts to die, and ultimately when Percival goes on his mission, it's that he has to get an understanding of that the land and the country and all of that is primary. And then he gets the Holy Grail and everything kind of comes back. So, you know, that's definitely the theme of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, practical effects just add so much. And, like, the armor in this, the armor is all custom made. And, it's, in fact, Adam Savage from Mythbusters several years ago went and found the original armorer and had him, you know, show him how to make it. And they made a King Arthur suit. And all this armor is aluminum because it's light. You know, you have to be able to move in it. But the way they rust it up and make it look aged and everything, it just works so well. And then when they're all shining again at the end, it hits you. You know, and like Lancelot, everyone else, through most of the movie, their armor is dirty unless it's a special occasion or whatnot. Lancelot's armor is always immaculate. It is always shining. And I should point out, because this is a Back to the Bins tie-in, the emblem of the Grail on Lancelot's armor, that's the exact way Mike W. Bard has it, and Brian Bolan draws it in Camelot 3000. It's just Mordred's armor, and that is gold. Here it's silver. Yeah, but it's the exact same emblem and everything. So, you know, we're tying it all together.
And my only other thought now is at the end, when he has to pull himself along the lance.
Yes.
Of all movies to make that callback, Shinzon in Star Trek, when he's after Picard and he does that mm-hmm. whole thing. So just a kind of a connection there. I think that was what inspired that scene, actually. Anyway, I'm going to say, personally, that this was a very difficult movie to rate, because I've always enjoyed it very much, top notch, to the point where I almost feel like I want to give it a Jaws, but I don't think it's quite a Jaws. And I'm going to say it's a high Jaws 2 for me, because I don't think it's perfect. I do think there's issues. And then when I look at those issues a little bit more closely, the pacing and the lack of bringing us from story point to story point, I'm going to say for a more objective finding that it's just a Jaws 2, as opposed to the high Jaws 2 that I want it to be. But I think it's at least a Jaws 2. I think the acting in it, the spectacle in it, it doesn't feel like 2 hours and 20 minutes when you're watching it. It's a good, solid Jaws 2. Somebody else want to go?
Yeah, I'll go next.
Yeah.
We're kind of in a different place on this one. I feel as a movie that covers, and I totally get why you're where you're at. For me, 2 hour and 20 minutes flies by on this one. I feel like the pacing is great on this one. I want more, like you said earlier. I would love a whole movie on Uther's story, but that's rating this film. This one is a low Jaws for me, but here's the reason why I think it's Jaws. Anybody listening to this, if you have no background in Arthurian legend, this tells a bang-up story telling you Arthurian legend. It captures all the pieces that you can. It's hard to do that in a two-hour movie, over a two-hour movie. To Paul's point about like the fact that this could be much, much more, sure, but it's a film. So I'm going to kind of go with my gut on this one. The music is spectacular. The special effects still hold up. This is a who's who of a cast in this film, and they all delivered. I mean, there's nobody who's like a weak link on this in the cast. Everybody was, I thought, perfectly cast. For me, it's very personal. It's obviously there's an emotional piece with that, so kind of take that for what it's worth off of that. That's one of the great things about doing this, I think, where you're doing it with a crew. I think all of our feelings are valid on this, and keep in mind, this is a very emotional response, but that's kind of where I'm at in this film. This is one of my shortlist films that I really, really love and feel like I always skip talking about.
Well, as you might expect, this is a Jaws for me. It is, like I said, it's the movie that started me down the path of getting into all the Arthurian stuff. The music is wonderful. The acting is amazing. It is one of the movies that I watch at least once a year. So I've seen this a number of times. And it's, yes, there are flaws. There's flaws in Jaws too. I mean,
shut your mouth.
This is what happens. When? Finish the line. But it's as good a telling of Arthur's entire life as you can ever get in a feature film. Anything more that you want to do with it has to be a miniseries, just a regular television series. There's so much that you can unpack there, but for a feature film, theatrically released, it's not going to get any better than this.
Fair enough. I'm not arguing the point. It's certainly, your mileage can vary, and I love watching this movie. I'm just trying to to put on my critic hat.
Paul, just to clarify what he said there's flaws in Jaws 2. That's why it's
flawed. Oh, yeah, okay. I can't argue that. So, thank you guys for coming on and doing this. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you in 2 weeks with another movie. Bye-bye.
My days are ended. The gods of once are gone forever. It's a time for men. It's your time.
I need you now, more than ever.
No. This is the moment that you must face at last, to be king alone.
And you, old friend? Will I see you again?
No. There are other worlds. This one is done with me.